Fall?
In the morning, I saw the doctor. He'd seen Colonel Brown, and they'd had words with Captain Morgan, the signals officer, and they agreed what to do. And that was that Sergeant Smith would tutor me for half an hour in the morning, half an hour in the afternoon, starting from basic Morse. And I was to have no other duties at all, and I was to relax and have as much pleasure in that as I could. Work, anything stressful was not to be there. So I started off straight away with Ron. As basic as that. And in 6 weeks' time, I'd got up to 16 words per minute. Originally, I'd done 22s, 23s. But I must admit that it was a beautiful 16 words per minute. And then walked the doctor. And, oh yes, he went out again, and 10 minutes later, just as we were finishing up the session, came in and said, "You're going up in the hills for a week's leave." I said, "Don't be daft, there's at least a 3 month waiting list to go up there." He said, "Why do you argue all the time? Is you're going up on in the morning on a week's leave in the hills?" "Oh, all right, thank you very much." I just made my arrangements, and then transport was there in the morning down to Colombo, train up in the hills to do Tilatadawa, and got there, and a very irate star sergeant said, "Room, don't know who you are." He says, "But some poor so-and-so's had his leave cancelled because of you." So I said, "Don't look at me, chum. I had nothing to do with it. I was just ordered up here by the doctor." "Oh, medical, is it?" And I said, "Apparently so." He says, "All right. Forget it, Sergeant." He said, "Have a good time." And it was a marvellous little leave centre up in the hills. You had no mosquitoes, no mosquito nettings. It was like a nice June day in England. And that was it. I had my leave and I went back down. "All right, Doc, what was all that about?" He said, "Ah, yes, that's better." He said, "You were as near a complete nervous breakdown as anybody I've seen when I sent you off." 2 days later, I was in Malaya. Following morning, I got briefed that a Major Hislop in Malaya wanted a British radio operator. And of course, by now, all our groups had gone into the field because of my being sick. And they briefed me, and they also briefed the other team with Alf Holdham. He was a operator for normal team of three of them. And the four of us were going to jump in together, and the other three were then supposed to be going off on their own, leaving me with Hislop and his Chinese.
How did you go in? In what kind of aircraft?
In a Liberator, which went from a airstrip called Minaria. Quite a hairy performance, inasmuch that Minaria was the bigger of the strips. It was only 1,600 yards of runway, with about a quarter of a mile of 3-foot-high tree stumps cleared each end in the jungle. The planes were at least 2,000 pound overload because of what was involved. The bomb bays, three quarters of them were filled with auxiliary tanks. Everything else had been taken out, could be. The radio was moved forward onto the flight deck. The upper gun turret was taken out. The guns were taken out the forward gun turret. The undergun turret was taken out, and only two guns were left in the rear turret with 1,000 rounds of ammo each. That was their sole armament. And on takeoff, there were two ways of taking off. Both of them, you got up on the flight deck, all of you. The radio operator wasn't needed at the time. It was by the escape hatch, which was in the roof behind the crash arch. And you got down like bung the barrel. And then the navigator, who doubled up as flight engineer, was on the throttles, and the pilot and co-pilot. They were heavy old planes to fly, apparently. You got to the end of the runway and you revved the engines up like mad against the brakes and then released. And the first way to do it was that you trundled down the runway until you got to rotate position, and the pilot then eased back the stick and hoped the hell you just cleared the tree stumps as you took off. And the moment the wheels left the ground, the co-pilot whipped them up and off you flew. The other way, which I hadn't experienced, I did see, but fortunately not see, you took it halfway along the runway, jerked back the tiller, made a jump in the air, then forward and bounced her up. And you did about three bounces like that. The only thing wrong with it was you rode off an undercar each time. It just about lasted for the return trip and no more. And then we, you climbed high up, 10,000 feet, 12,000 feet, to clear Ceylon, and then you went down low. In fact, when you got as far as the Nicobar Islands, you went down what they called 50 feet. In fact, you took the plane down until the tips of the propellers were just spraying the sea, and that was to get under the Japanese radar. And then we went up the valley in Perak to where we were going to drop. And we were fortunate in as much that they'd found a couple of holes in the jungle there where natives had planted some rice or something at some time. And he dropped us one in each hole. It was precision bombing at its best, because you he came in at 250 feet, which was only something like 50 or 60 feet above the top of the trees. To go out of the plane in a Liberator, there's only a square hatch in the bottom immediately forward of the rear turret, and they had made like a children's plywood slide to fit into that, so you slid down it and you had another one over the top, so as you were shooted out. And the slowest that the plane could go was about 150 knots, which was rather faster than what you would normally do for status shoot drop. So you, on the word go, you went immediately, and as soon as you were out, of course, you just went woof, level behind the plane. Your status cord just pulled out your chute, and at that height, all that happened was that you just suddenly swung down, the chute opened out, and you hit the ground. You had no more than that. But anyway, it worked fine. We did the two. I was a little bit annoyed myself, because I'd eaten rather well on the plane. They'd given us some beautiful food out of the raft. And when we came to the DZ, because they're going to drop some containers in first, and then the other pods all had to get kitted up and ready to go, and we only had a small crew, I had to go into the rear gun turret and become Tail End Charlie. that meant putting the turret all over the sky to keep watch. And I just had time to get all this food up before I got my chute on and jumped out myself.
What date was it that you went in, do you think?
That would be about June in 45.
Who was the other person who dropped?
Alf Holden was the other operator. The team was led by Major Latham and backed up by Captain White. I was to go into a Major Hislop.
And you went into a valley in Pira, you said?
Pirac, near Baling.
And was that descent perfectly okay, as far as you were concerned?
As far as I was concerned, it was just a means of getting from the air to the ground. It was so fast, it was over and done with like that. 1 minute I was in the plane, next minute I was on the ground.
Any reception committee there?
Yes, and there was the Chinese interpreter from Hislop's team was there to greet us, and he took the four of us to a little kampong nearby where we stayed the night. And then the following day, we started travelling up through the jungle until we eventually met Major Hislop on the trail. And from there, we went on about another half day's journey to where he'd made a camp. And he had two Chinese operators there and a Malaysian timberman who he'd known in his plantation days. Major Hislop, I should say, was an ex-plantation manager. And he looked after our basic needs up there. He did most of the native cooking.
Did you feel more apprehensive about going into a Japanese-occupied area than into a German-occupied area?
Yes, I suppose I did. One had heard so many stories of atrocities by the Japanese, and yet after France, and knowing how the French were with their atrocities to people, and having heard one or two things about the Germans from some of our other colleagues, that had been watered down quite a bit. The French were really brutal to people. They were uncivilized.
For example?
Well, down in Nîmes, for example, they, in fact, anywhere down south, you only had to turn around and say, "Look, a woman slept with a German," and she was immediately pounced on with no defense at all. She'd be stripped naked, shaven, defiled in every possible way, and then dragged through the streets behind a car or lorry or something like that, with people doing all kinds of things to them. You used to get quite a few of those doing that.
Did you see that?
Oh, yes, I saw that in Nîmes. The only person I knew who managed to combat that was a Major Croft, and that's not his real name. He's an ex-Arctic explorer, and I still don't know who he is. But he led a team of naval personnel who were rigged up similar to SAS with jeeps and .5 caliber Browning machine guns. And he was down in Montpellier, and he got so incensed with this, he put his jeeps at the junctions of the crossroads, got on to Radio Montpellier and said, "Either you stop this immediately or my troops open up regardless."
Did you see that?
And that stopped. I didn't see that. I had that from him and his chaps afterwards.
Where did you meet him?
In Nîmes. He came up to Nîmes from Montpellier. He should be able to be traced somehow or the other, but I don't have the means. He had the Arctic Cross, and to my knowledge, there was only 14 members who ever received the Arctic Cross.
What makes you think it's not his real name?
Well, he said it wasn't his real name. And I certainly looked up holders of the Arctic Cross, and there was no Major Croft on it.
So the French were just taking the word of anybody who accused?
Yeah. What I did see afterwards, and my major didn't want to know anything about, was the fact that we had had about 5,000 Balkan troops surrender to the Maquis up in Vas, and they put them all in the prison there. They hadn't fed them at all in 3 weeks. They'd managed to get water, so a week. And the French were whining and dining every night. For their entertainment, they used to get a load of these prisoners out into the courtyard and see how many pieces they could shoot off of them before they killed them. Now, I did see part of that.
To how many men did they do? Did you
see
them
do
that?
I had no idea. Oh, they had about 50 of them at a time into the courtyard.
They were just taking pot shots at them?
Just taking pot shots. Their arms were tied behind their backs and just getting their guns and ping, ping.
At Vals?
Vals. V-A-L-S. That's in the Rhone Valley up towards Lyon.
Which resistance was this that was doing that?
No idea. Communists, I would say. They were nearly all were communists there, that's what I would say.
You say Balkans, do you mean Bulgarians or Yugoslavs or what?
They were from the other side of Yugoslavia, as far as I know. I'm sorry, my geography is very poor, and I can't remember now the exact name they called these chaps.
But they
were mercenary troops to the Germans, that's all I knew.
So after they'd shot bits off them, did they finish them off?
Oh, yes, they were all killed and taken away and disposed of. Again, I don't know even how they disposed of them, whether they just buried them or whether they burnt them, you know.
Did it make you wonder whether what you were doing was right when you saw something like that?
Well, I'd wondered, as you may have surmised, for a long time, which was the best side to be on, ours or the Germans at times, with the behaviour of the French. Certainly on hindsight, all right, I'm an elderly man now, but if I was asked to go in again to help French be liberated, I wouldn't do it.
Why not?
Because I don't feel any sympathy for French. In fact, I dislike the French quite a lot. I've been over to France numerous times since, and I just don't like them as a nation, I'm afraid. Obviously, that's a generalisation. I mean, there's nice Frenchmen as well as not so nice. But as a nation, I'm not keen on them at all.
Now, can we go back to Japan? Because you'd made contact with Hislop.
Yes.
And we hadn't really taken the story any further.
Right. In relation to Hislop, perhaps it would be better just to return to Ceylon for a minute, to part of my training. While I was training there, getting more jungle experience, we had a Gurkha detachment come in. This was 5 squads of Gurkhas, of about 20 in each, under the command of a Major W. Travers, who's Bill Travers, the film star, more known as these days, and...
Bill Travers?
Bill Travers. That's Virginia McKenna's husband. He was in charge of these, and then they had these five groups. Of course, each had their British officer, Indian command, viceroy officer, and the usual sergeant and naik underneath them. Well, when they first came in, they were all going out onto a scheme to get themselves more training in the jungle, and one of their officers was in hospital, and they wanted to have an Englishman out with each group, you see. So the Goldberg came to me and said, would I mind going out with these chaps, be their operator, and also be general mentor to them, you see. So I said, no, not at all. It was with some trepidation, because the Gurkhas, as you well know, have a hell of a reputation. And when we came to go out, Major Goldberg came to me, he said, right, what rations do you want? So I said, well, what do they eat? So I said, well, rice and hot stuff and so on. So I said, all right, fine, I'll have theirs. You sure? So I said, yeah. He said, well, I'll put a 7-day man pack in your kit anyway. And that's English rations, just in case. So I said, okay, fine. And off we went. Well, now, there was the radio, there was my kit, and a battery for operating radio. And if these Gurks felt like it, they would have just left me to carry the lot, which would have been an impossibility. But fortunately, the Viceroy officer turned around and said, oh, we'll carry the radio and the battery for you. We went in. A cut a long story short, I hit it off with these boys, well and truly. We weren't very successful in our mission as far as having a drop. We got to wrong DZ. We saw the plane flying down alongside us, and it didn't matter what we did, didn't. And we ended up at 2 o'clock in the morning with me teaching them British ballroom dancing out in the jungle. And they thought that was hilarious. I also taught them how to set the radio up for me, to put the aerial up and the battery on, and then I would tune it and so on. And they thought this was marvellous, you know, they were doing their bit. And it accumulated when we, at the end of the scheme, we ran into the other four. For some reason or the other, they all had Chinese operators at that time on the scheme. And, Sergeant, glad to see you. You've got to help us. So, oh yeah, what's the problem? Again, it was a Sten gun business. One of the Gurkhas had carried his Sten gun with a round up the spout, and banged it against his knee and shot himself up through the jaw and killed himself. And out there, of course, you've got to do everything within 24 hours. Their Chinese operators had been trained. They hadn't got through at all on any of their ordinary skeds, and they'd been trying on emergency for about 3 hours when I got there, and weren't getting anywhere. God knows why. I just can't understand it. They had the same equipment as me and that. So, of course, my Viceroy officer was with me. He said, oh, that's all right. He said, Sergeant Saab soon get through. And so, would you? So I said, right. So we doubled back to where we'd left the others. And I said, right, radio up. And they got the radio up. Aerial there, so on, down. And every dog has its day, I suppose. I tuned in to the emergency signal, got it, straight away, loud and clear. Tuned in my set to their frequency. Tapped out. Immediately, it stopped. They'd received me virtually my first tap on the button. I passed the message, of course, in clear. Wait two. 2 minutes later, back came the message. Transport will be at so-and-so place at such and such a time. Full arrangements will be made down in Colombo for the cremation. So, and it was less than 20 minutes from the time I left this officer to the time I got back again. And as I came up, they were all agitated. What are you doing here, son? We thought we asked you to try and help. I said, whoa. I said, I've been through it. I said, transport will be at so-and-so place at such and such an hour. Cremation details will be there. Of course, I smelt sweeter than all the roses in Kew Gardens, So that was it. And so when I was out with Heslop, Malaya was one of these funny places. The people that he was arming were at the very least bandits. We hoped to be able to use them against the Japs. And they were the only people we could get hold of. Although I have read since that we were supposed to have known, certainly we had no idea of the communist infiltration going on around. And we had... We were getting this lot together. We had another major, while we were there, we had several little contretemps. We had a intelligence unit amongst the natives down in the Baling Valley, and he'd informed us that the Japs were putting big akak concentration along there because they were fed up with our liberators coming in at 4 o'clock in the afternoon about once a week, and that they were going to shoot them down. So we said thank you and sent a message back, and the Lib said thanks very much, we'll come in the other route, and did so. So they were that, and then flying over our jungle position, we used to be able to climb up a tree to see some of the sky, was a Japanese copy of Dakota. And this was the Mao plane from Thailand down to Kuala Lumpur. And that used to come over at about 4:15 every day on the dot, which was around the time that our Libs came, you see. And we told them about that, and they said, oh, we'll see if we can do something. And I think about the week following, we had a big drop with three Libs coming in. And they circled round the DZ that we have, which is only a hole in the jungle with some smoke coming out. And one of them, I was watching from the tree, from this observation post,